1 Kings chapter 9. As soon as Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house and all that Solomon desired to build, the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time, as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. And the Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your plea which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house that you have built by putting my name there forever. My eyes and my heart will be there for all time. And as for you, if you will walk before me, as David your father walked, with integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and keeping my statutes and my rules, then I will establish your royal throne over Israel forever, as I promised David your father, saying, You shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. But if you turn aside from following me, you or your children, and do not keep my commandments and my statutes that I have set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them, and the house that I have consecrated for my name I will cast out of my sight, and Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all peoples. And this house will become a heap of ruins. Everyone passing by it will be astonished and will hiss, and they will say, Why has the Lord done thus to this land and to this house? Then they will say, Because they abandoned the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt, and laid hold on other gods and worshipped them and served them. Therefore the Lord has brought all this disaster on them. At the end of 20 years in which Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house, and Hiram, king of Tyre, had supplied Solomon with cedar and cypress, timber and gold, as much as he desired, King Solomon gave to Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee. But when Hiram came from Tyre to see the cities that Solomon had given him, they did not please him. Therefore he said, What kind of cities are these that you have given me, my brother? So they are called the land of Kabul to this day. Hiram had sent to the king 120 talents of gold. And this is the account of the forced labor that King Solomon drafted to build the house of the Lord and his own house, and the Millo, and the wall of Jerusalem, and Hazor, and Megiddo, and Giza. Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and captured Giza and burned it with fire, and had killed the Canaanites who lived in the city, and had given it as dowry to his daughter, Solomon's wife. So Solomon rebuilt Giza, and lower Beth-horon, and Baalath, and Tamar in the wilderness in the land of Judah, and all the store cities that Solomon had, and the cities for his chariots, and the cities for his horsemen, and whatever Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem, in Lebanon, and in all the land of his dominion. All the people who were left of the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, who were not of the people of Israel, their descendants who were left after them in the land, whom the people of Israel were unable to devote to destruction, these Solomon drafted to be slaves, and so they are to this day. But of the people of Israel, Solomon made no slaves. They were the soldiers, they were his officials, his commanders, his captains, his chariot commanders, and his horsemen. These were the chief officers who were over Solomon's work, 550 who had charge of the people who carried on the work. But Pharaoh's daughter went up from the city of David to her own house that Solomon had built for her. Then he built the Millo. 3 times a year, Solomon used to offer up burnt offerings and peace offerings on the altar that he built to the Lord, making offerings with it before the Lord. So he finished the house. King Solomon built a fleet of ships at Ezion-Geber, which is near Eloth on the shore of the Red Sea, in the land of Edom. And Hiram sent with the fleet his servants, seamen, who were familiar with the sea, together with the servants of Solomon. And they went to Ophir, and brought from there gold, 420 talents, and they brought it to King Solomon.
We are continuing our reading in 1 Kings chapter 10, starting at verse 1. Now when the queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. She came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue, with camels bearing spices and very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she told him all that was on her mind. And Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from the king that he could not explain to her. And when the queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food of his table, the seating of his officials, and the attendance of his servants, their clothing, his cupbearers, and his burnt offerings that he offered at the house of the Lord, there was no more breath in her. And she said to the king, "The report was true that I heard in my own land of your words and of your wisdom, but I did not believe the reports until I came and my own eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity surpass the report that I heard. Happy are your men, happy are your servants, who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, he has made you king, that you may execute justice and righteousness." Then she gave the king 120 talents of gold and a very great quantity of spices and precious stones. Never again came such an abundance of spices as these that the queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Moreover, the fleet of Hiram, which brought gold from the Ophir, brought from Ophir a very great amount of almug wood and precious stones. And the king made of the almug wood supports for the house of the Lord and for the king's house, also lyres and harps for the singers. No such almug wood has come or been seen to this day. And King Solomon gave to the queen of Sheba all that she desired, whatever she asked, besides what was given her by the bounty of King Solomon. So she turned and went back to her own land with her servants. Now the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold, besides that which came from the explorers and from the business of the merchants and from all the kings of the west and from the governors of the land. King Solomon made 200 large shields of beaten gold. 600 shekels of gold went into each shield, and he made 300 shields of beaten gold. 3 minas of gold went into each shield, and the king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. The king also made a great ivory throne and overlaid it with the finest gold. The throne had 6 steps, and the throne had a round top. And on each side of the seat were armrests, and 2 lions standing beside the armrests, while 12 lions stood there, one on each end of a step on the 6 steps. The like of it was never made in any kingdom. All King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None were silver. Silver was not considered as anything in the days of Solomon. For the king had a fleet of ships from Tarshish at sea with the fleet of Hiram. Once every 3 years, the fleet of ships of Tarshish used to come bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks. Thus King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom. And the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. Every one of them brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, myrrh, spices, horses and mules, so much year by year. And Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen, whom he stationed in the chariot cities and with the king in Jerusalem. And the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone, and he made cedar as plentiful as the sycamore of the Shephelah. And Solomon's import of horses was from Egypt and Kew, and the king's traders received them from Kew at a price. A chariot could be imported from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver, and a horse for 150. And so, through the king's traders, they were exported to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria.
Welcome to a few faces I don't recognize, and hopefully, do stay around at the end. It'd be nice to be able to speak to you in person. I'm in a couple of weeks' time going to see Oliver and Lena, that some of you will remember, members of the congregation here. They're now living in Dublin, where Oliver works for the aeronautical industry. I think he works for Aer Lingus. And I had the privilege a year ago of travelling with Oliver, in his little aeroplane that he has a share in, piloted by him with two friends. And it's a little bit like a flying lawnmower, you know, a tiny little engine, and you're shaking above the ground. You can look down, it looks very, very close. And Oliver looks extremely competent, so you feel vaguely safe. But it did remind me of the story of two guys talking in the pub. One of them's called Bill, about his first solo flight that he'd done the previous week. "Oh, that's good," said the friend. "Well, not that good," said Bill. The engine caught fire at 3,000 feet. "Ouch, that's bad," said the friend. "Well, he's okay because he had a parachute." "Oh, that's good," said Bill. "Not that good," said the friend. "The parachute failed to open." "That's bad," said Bill. "Oh, it was okay," said the friend, "because just below him in the field where he was falling, there was a giant fluffy haystack." "That's good," said the friend. "Not that good," said Bill. "There was a pitchfork sticking up right in the middle of the haystack." "Ouch, that's bad," said Bill. "It was okay," said the friend. He missed the pitchfork." "That's good," said the friend. It wasn't, said Bill. "You see, he missed the haystack too." It's a gratuitous preacher's story. Good news or bad news, and you don't find out until the end which it actually was. And it's a bit similar with these chapters of 1 Kings. As they were being read, I wonder if you thought, "That's good," or "Not so good." And it does go a bit one way than the other, and you're not quite sure, and in the end, we find out. I want to take all that's good first, and then all that's bad second. So if you open the service sheet, you'll see an outline of where we're going, and we'll start here. There's so much that is good in Solomon's kingdom. So much is good. And the way that the book works is we're introduced to Solomon in chapter 1-2. We heard about his wisdom and his riches in chapters 3 and 4. Then we heard the story of the temple being built, the great wonder of the ancient world. And now we come to a sort of closing bracket where once again we just summarize his wisdom and his wealth. And you'll see that chapter 3, chapter 9, chapter 4, chapter 10, they kind of pair each other. Chapter 3 and 4 at the beginning, chapter 9 and 10 at the end, and they enclose everything in between. And you see these summaries just on the sheet. Previously, God answered Solomon's prayer for wisdom at a place called Gibeon. And then once again here in chapter 9, God answers Solomon's prayer for the temple at Gibeon. And previously in chapter 4, we were told that Judah and Israel were very happy. And again, we're told in chapter 10, "Happy are your men, happy are your servants." In chapter 4, we were told that people of all the nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. He was internationally famous. In chapter 10, we're told the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom. So at the beginning and the end of the story of Solomon, we are told God answers his prayers. People are very, very happy under his rule. And he is internationally famous for being so wise. This is a fantastic time to live in Israel. This is the high point of the kingdom in all of history. And the best insight we get into that is a little case study. We're told the general, people thought he was wise and people came to see him. But then we're told about one specific lady who made a visit to see what he was up to. She's called the Queen of Sheba. And thanks to the British musician Handel, the arrival of the Queen of Sheba now makes us think of music that many of you perhaps had at your wedding as you went down the aisle. But Handel composed it for his oratorio about King Solomon and the moment when this lady shows up. She is an important lady. She comes with a very great retinue. Claudia was just asking earlier, what is a retinue? She was reading it. I don't really know. I think it just means a whole lot of stuff. You know, she's not a lady who packs light, the Queen of Sheba. She comes with chariots laden with spices, a huge amount of gold, loads of diamonds, etc., etc. This is a big deal state visit. And it turns out she is not so sure about the claims of Solomon. I love people like that in the Bible. They're not prepared to take things gullibly, just on hearsay. They want to find out for themselves. And so she's heard that Solomon is very wealthy, and so she decides to check. And in particular, we're told she comes to test him with hard questions. So you can imagine, hey, she turns out, I've heard that you're a wise guy. I've got an exam paper for you to sit, and then I'll decide. Okay, so she comes and asks him everything she can think of, everything that is on her mind. And Solomon passes the test. Verse 3 of chapter 10, Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from the king that he could not explain to her. The way that maths exams used to work in Cambridge, I think maths was the hardest subject at the university. And the way the exams used to work is rather than you having to, you know, choose six questions or whatever, it just said attempt as many questions as you like. And basically they were so difficult that if you got three questions fully right, you got a first. There's a whole load of cheese, so maybe 30 questions. It was expected you'd maybe get about, you know, five half questions done. Three questions completely right, that's a first. A friend of mine's brother completed the paper. That's how bright he was. And I think Solomon's a bit like that. He answered all of her questions. This is the highest first ever attained in the University of the Queen of Sheba, in which she is chief examiner. And she concludes, you really are quite smart, aren't you? When, verse 4, the Queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house he built, that's the temple, the food of his table, the seating of his officials, the attendants of his servants, their clothing, his cupbearers, and his burnt offerings that he offered at the house of the Lord, there was no more breath in her. She said to the king, the report was true that I heard in my own land of your words and your wisdom, but I didn't believe the reports until I came and my own eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity surpassed the report I heard. Happy are your men, happy are your servants, who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. I love this paragraph. I think, given that the Bible is a very, very old book, and the King James translation of the Bible is a seminal work in the history of English language printed, I think this is the first occurrence anywhere in literature of three now very well-known phrases. Did you spot them just in that paragraph? Three phrases that we know really well. I think this is the first time they were ever said. Firstly, it took her breath away. There was no more breath left in her. Secondly, the half wasn't told me. I hadn't heard the half of it. Thirdly, I've seen it with my own eyes. It's pretty cool, isn't it? That all of those phrases, perhaps for the first time. If you find differently, do let me know before I repeat that claim inaccurately. But I think it might be the first time. But she's basically saying, wow, now you really are cleverer than I even imagined. And I've never seen riches like this. It's slightly difficult for us to understand because the measuring unit is talents. If you look at the bottom of the page, it tells you that a talent is about 34 kilos, which makes, according to my maths, 420 talents, which is how much they bring from Ophir every 3 years. That makes that about 14 tons of gold per 3 years. Not to mention all the precious stones, not to mention the peacocks and the apes and the silver and ivory. In fact, silver... And people don't even bother with silver. You know, silver's like nothing. You might as well use silver instead of using, you know, brass in those days. People only cared about gold, and there was an enormous amount of gold. And she goes, wow. I hadn't heard the half of it. It's taken my breath away. This was the high point in the history of God's people. And everyone in the whole of the world wants to know about it. Now, you couldn't really say the same, could you, about the church, or certainly in this country. You know, our gathering here today is an irrelevance to most people in London and most people in Greenwich. They don't even know we're here, and they don't care if we are. But in those days, God's kingdom, the kingdom of Solomon, was so internationally famous that people everywhere wanted to come and see. And see what it was like. This was the high point in the history of the people. And my favourite verse in the chapter is chapter 10, verse 9. Just look at it together. Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, he has made you king, that you may execute justice and righteousness. This is a lovely verse. It tells us that it's not just that Solomon is clever for his own benefit, and he's not just wealthy so that he can live a luxurious life. We're told that the blessing of his prosperity and his wisdom overflows to everybody in his kingdom. And so the queen says to him, your God must really love your people. It doesn't say he must really love you. He says he must really love Israel, mustn't he, your God, if he's made you their king. To give a country a king like that, what a huge blessing from the Lord. Sometimes people say that, don't they, that you get the government that you deserve. And certainly that will be true later in 1 and 2 Kings. There's some pretty terrible kings. And you might say it's what they got coming. They asked for it. You might say the same about us or about countries like Russia or America. You know, and some of the slightly extraordinary world leaders we now see sitting around the table. Maybe that is what we deserve. Well, she says of Israel, you are really fortunate. And God must really love you to give you a king who is just and wise and prosperous. And you're all happy. What a blessing that is from the Lord. So I think you can read these chapters as an extraordinary high. That's good, said Bill. Not that good, said the friend. Because even as we're enjoying one of the happiest parts of the whole of the Bible, there is just a note of unease, a little thread that comes through it that tells us that everything is not quite right. And the effect on us, I think, is to make us very, very uneasy. And I've likened this before, some of you have heard this illustration, I've likened it before to the beginning of an episode of Casualty. If you ever saw that TV show, you must have done, because it was running on British TV for, is it still going? It's still going. Okay, so I mean, it was going when I was a kid, so it's at least 30 years. I'm not 30, I'm 42, but I mean, I started watching Casualty when I was about 12. It's still going. And the Casualty episodes always used to go the same way. You start with some really happy scene of a family playing on the beach or something, and you couldn't enjoy it because you knew this is a show about the accident and emergency department in hospital, or the emergency room for American friends, and you just thought, this is going to end badly. One of these happy, smiley children is going to get horribly injured, and the ambulance is going to come along, and then we're going to spend the entire episode trying to save their life. So because it was Casualty, you were unable to enjoy the scene of utopian happiness and bliss at the beginning, because you knew something is going to go wrong, and it's all going to be ruined. And I would suggest that is exactly how these chapters work of 1 and 2 Kings. At the point when everything is so wonderful, there's just a little thread through it that makes you uneasy. And you think, what if this were all about to unravel? I want to just show you that so you can see what I mean. And the first thing that makes you uneasy is this strand. Actually, it's been all the way through 1 Kings, but we've saved it until now to notice it. Maybe you spotted it in previous readings. A strand that all of God's promises, all of God's blessings for his kingdom, for his people, are contingent on, they depend on the faithfulness of the king. They're not guaranteed. They're guaranteed only if the king is faithful. Molly has printed out all for us, all of those passages on the second side of the sheet. So just follow them with me. Chapter 2, this is David giving a pep talk to his son, Solomon, just as he's about to become king. And he says, if your sons pay close attention to your way, to walk before me in faithfulness with all their heart and all their soul, then you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. Now, sounds great, but it's an if promise. The line of David, the line of great kings, is going to continue so long as your sons pay careful attention to their way, to walk before me in faithfulness with all their heart and all their soul. And so the pessimists among you start thinking, but what if they don't? And what if they're not faithful? What will happen then? And it's just left hanging. Then God speaks to Solomon in chapter 3, the first appearance at Gibeon. And he says this, if you will walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments, as your father David walked, then I will lengthen your days. Now, you can have a long reign, but not necessarily. You can have a long reign if you're faithful to me. Then, as they're building the temple in chapter 6, we read this. Concerning this house you're building, if you'll walk in my statutes and obey my rules and keep all my commandments and walk in them, then I will establish my word with you, which I spoke to David your father, and I will dwell among the children of Israel, and I will not forsake my people Israel. It's a great promise, isn't it? I'll never forsake you. It's a slightly less great promise if it goes, I'll never forsake you if. I'll never forsake you if you walk in my ways, obey my rules, keep all my commandments, and walk in them. It's just bubbling along there, this note of conditionality through 1 Kings. And then when you get to chapter 9, it's like the author turns up the volume on the if. And not only does he make it louder, but the if you do and if you don't suddenly get out of proportion. And if you don't takes more than half of the space. Just look at this paragraph. We heard this read today, but listen to it again. But if you turn aside from following me, you or your children. So we got one verse on if you follow me. And we got four verses on if you turn aside from following me. If you do not keep my commandments and my statutes set before you, but you go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land I've given them. The house I've consecrated for my name, I will cast out of my sight. Israel will become a proverb and a byword among all the nations. This house shall become a heap of ruins. Everyone passing by will be astonished and will hiss, and they'll say, why has the Lord done this to this land and this house? Then they will say, because they abandoned the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt and laid hold of other gods and worshipped them and served them. Therefore, the Lord has brought all this disaster on them. Do you notice it goes through every one of the blessings of Solomon's kingdom and warns that each of these could be lost? The blessing of prosperity in the land. And God warns, I will cut off Israel from the land. The blessing of international fame. Remember, people all over the world came to hear of Solomon's wisdom. Will become international ridicule. Israel will become a proverb among all the peoples. They'll hiss. You heard what happened to them. And most of all, this wonderful temple that he built, we heard about it for the last 2 weeks on Sunday, this temple will become cast out of God's sight. It will become a heap of rubble. The high point of their history, but with a big if. Be careful. This is yours only as long as you are faithful. And some of us are wondering as pessimists, what if they're not? But the first readers of 1 Kings know that they weren't. Where is this book of 1 Kings first published? In a faraway land of Babylon, in exile. Many of the people having been killed, the temple having been destroyed. And they read the story, I guess wistfully, of all that was lost. Once we were the greatest of all nations. Once, people of every nation came to hear our king. And now they laugh and deride and scorn, because all there is in Jerusalem is a heap of rubble. A great blessing, but only if. And actually, even as we read the story of Solomon in these chapters, there are clues that something isn't quite right already. They're quite subtle clues, but they're there if you look closely enough. For example, Hiram, previously a great example of Solomon's wise international relations, is now treated rather poorly. Chapter 9, verse 7. Chapter 9, verse 12. When Hiram came from Tyre to see the city Solomon had given him, they didn't please him. What kind of cities are these that you've given me? Solomon snubs Hiram, and Hiram snubs Solomon. A bit of a breakdown in relations. We're then told that the draft of labor, those he'd recruited to build the city, included, verse 21, chapter 9, verse 21, the descendants who were left after them in the land, whom the people of Israel were unable to devote to destruction. These ones Solomon drafted to be slaves, and they are to this day. Now, that's only significant to you if you know the backstory, but God told them when they went into the land of the Canaanites, they were to leave no one living. They were to bring God's judgment on the people. Otherwise, God said, those people shall become thorns in your sides, and their gods will be a snare to you. But Solomon makes a compromise and recruits these people, these pagan idolaters, into draft to build his temple. And then most of all, the clearest clue of all is right at the end of the chapter, end of chapter 10, when we're told about Solomon's business of horse trading, literal horse trading. He bought horses from Egypt, and then he sells them to all over the kingdom. Listen to God's instructions concerning the monarchy in the book of Deuteronomy. He, Israel's king, must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses. Since the Lord said to you, you shall never return that way again. He shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. See, it looks wonderful, this prosperity. Except God had warned, be careful not to have too much money. Be careful not to have too many horses. Be careful specifically that your horses don't come from Egypt, the place that I brought you out as free people from slavery. Don't go back there. And then we read of a king who is a little bit too rich. We read a description of his throne with, I mean, it's quite an impressive thing, isn't it? There's a lion on each side of the armrest, and then there's six steps going down with lions at each side of the steps. I mean, it looks pretty cool, but it's made of gold. It's a little bit too much gold, maybe. We read of the horses, a few too many horses. Then we read the horses come from Egypt, which is precisely the wrong place to get your horses from. And we start to really worry. God said, all of this blessing is yours if you're faithful. And yet we start to see the cracks appear everywhere before us. It's all about to come crashing down. What is the effect of this on the first reader? The reader opening the book of 1 Kings, first published in exile in Babylon. I guess there's a feeling of wistfulness, the sort of nostalgia. You know, it's not, things aren't like they used to be. I mean, literally they're not. And once we were famous, now we're in ruins. A feeling of tragedy, a feeling of all that's lost. Maybe a longing for something like Solomon's kingdom, but with a crucial difference. If only we could have the prosperity and the justice and the wisdom and the international fame. But if only we could have that in a way that wasn't going to be shaken, a way that was safe and durable, and you could enjoy the happy family at the beginning of the casualty episode and think it was just an episode about a happy family and not have to fear the tragedy that was looming round the corner. See, great riches are nothing, are they, if you don't get to keep them? Who wants to be a millionaire for a day and then lose everything and spend the rest of your life in prison? Now, if only we could keep it. A few years ago, I went to see Macbeth, I think three different times. I saw it in the theatre. That is more times than anyone ought to see Macbeth in a year. It's quite a depressing film. But I saw it in the cinema. The new Macbeth film, I saw a play of it, and then I saw a friend of mine acting in it. And there's a line in Macbeth where it actually starts with the problems, but Macbeth finds himself King of Scotland, and the line says, to be thus is nothing. To be a king of Scotland, that's nothing. But to be safely thus. Now, what Macbeth longs for is to be king and to be able to hold on to being king. If any could have prosperity and keep it, if any could have international fame and it wouldn't be lost, if any could be great and it wasn't shakable, well, they look back with wistfulness. But the Christian looks to the kingdom of the Lord Jesus. And we realize it's everything that Solomon's kingdom was. But it's also safe. Jesus is unbelievably wealthy. I mean, he is heir to the entire universe. And all the gold in the universe. He made it, let alone just received it on ships. He is going to be on the last day. I mean, he already is unbelievably famous. Probably a billion people in the world worshipping him. On the last day, every knee will bow to him. Incredibly famous. Jesus is unbelievably wise. In him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Jesus is very, very like Solomon. He's Solomon par excellence. But there's one difference. When we're told, if you will walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, I will lengthen my days. And we think to ourselves, yeah, Jesus is pretty safe on that one. If you will walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments, concerning this house I'm building, if you walk in my statutes and obey my rules and keep all my commandments, then I will establish my word with you. You think, yes, Jesus is pretty safe on that. If you turn aside from following me, you and your children, do not keep my commandments. We think, no, Jesus never did that. You see, the reason Jesus' kingdom is unshakable is because Jesus was always faithful. He never did anything to jeopardize the promises that were made to him and those he ruled. He never did anything to challenge God's blessing and favor of him. And so, there's still an if, but the if is absolutely safe. We are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken. Now, it's invisible at the moment, Jesus' kingdom. You can't see it. It's not a geographical place like Solomon's was with known borders and with ships coming in. You can't say, oh, here's a ship coming in for Jesus' kingdom. It doesn't work like that. And the rule of it doesn't have chariot cities. You can't say, well, there are the Christian chariots. People have tried that in history, largely because they badly misunderstood the Bible and went off trying to conquer in Jesus' name. Jesus says, no, my kingdom's not of this world. It's not advanced with swords and clubs. It's an invisible kingdom for now. But one day it will be seen. And people all over the world will marvel at it. As Jesus said, the Queen of the South came to hear of the wisdom of Solomon. But now one greater than Solomon is here. If you're a Christian, rejoice in being part of the greatest kingdom the world has ever seen that is safe, unshakable, because it's conditional on the faithfulness of the Lord Jesus, and he passes the test. And if you're not a Christian here today, I guess even if we are Christians, and there's other things we want to trust in, the prosperity of the euro, if you're a Remainer, or the prosperity of the pound, if you're a Brexiteer, or your particular career path, if you're ambitious, or the success of your solo music career, if you're a music student. Or the wonder of your family, if you're a mum or a dad. You know, whatever it is that we want to put our hope in, they're not ultimately secure things. Fragile things. Shakeable things. But the kingdom of the Lord Jesus cannot ever be shaken. We're going to take a pause, and then Robbie's going to lead us in prayer.